This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and to the part of the program we call the Big Picture. If you recall, going back to the days of yesteryear, back in 2002, Jim, you published an article called The Next Big Thing. And in that article in 2002, I remember you predicted the next big shift was going to be in the area of commodities, notably gold or just precious metals in general, and of course, oil. This was not in vogue at the time. You followed that article, by the way, in the same year with your whole Power Shift series on both war and oil. And so what it was is we saw this trend emerging of a bull market in commodities and a bull market in gold, which for, what was it, years, everybody kept saying, this is a bubble, it's a bubble, it's going to burst, rather than recognizing the bull market that was there. So when you see a trend like this, and you really believe that this is what is going to happen, what do you do at your firm to take advantage of this type of a trend shift? Now, remember, back in 2002, nobody believed in gold and oil as the next upcoming thing. Everybody was still hanging on to the tech bubble boom of the 90s, which goes in line with what you were talking about, the multiple stages of a bull market, where the street's always the last crowd, you know, the average small investor is the last crowd to hang in there as everybody else is moving out of it. And the reason we're doing this is we're going into another shift, and we have to ask, what does that mean? So when you see a trend, what do you do?
Well, I mean, going back to 1999, John, things just got crazy. And of course, you remember the events leading up to Y2K, where, you know, where the train's going to, where the lights going to come on.
Right. And never go out again. Yeah, right. In other words, lights are going to go out and they are never going to come back, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay.
Yeah. I can remember sailing in the bay on New Year's Eve, 1999, with my son and a couple friends of mine, and we had the radio turned on the boat, waiting to see if the lights came on in Australia. So, I mean, the Y2K threat was perceived to be real. But anyway, we got out of stocks in December, and we went into, it's hard to believe because we're doing the opposite right now, but we went into European government bonds because we saw a recession. The Fed was raising interest rates. Oil prices went from $10 in 1998 all the way up to $35 a barrel by 2000. So we knew that when the Fed was raising interest rates, and back then they were doing it a lot more aggressively than they did in 2004, what the Fed's done recently. So we saw the Fed raising interest rates. The dollar was coming down. Things were crazy in the market, and we knew we were heading for a recession. So we moved into foreign government bonds, mainly European bonds. At that time, Germany, France, Switzerland, Canada, Australia, and the rest we just kept in cash. And for a while, we looked like idiots because the NASDAQ went from 4,000 where it ended the year in 1999, and it hit 5,000 in March, but then things began to fall apart. It really wasn't clear to me, other than going into European sovereign debt, which is kind of strange because we're shorting European sovereign debt now. But back then, there wasn't a clear trend. We knew we were heading for a recession. Oil prices had spiked, and the Fed was raising interest rates. But however, by the summer of 2001, we were now in a recession. The Fed was beginning to lower interest rates, and we saw another cycle that was developing. And I was very much influenced back then by the work of John Murphy in his inner market analysis trends, and then also the work of Barry Bannister at Stifel Nicolaus, and also Jim Rogers, who had just come back from a whirlwind tour where he went around the world for 3 years with his now wife. And I saw that trend in commodities because commodities had been in a bear market for nearly 2 decades. So gradually, we began to take positions in gold first, then oil, and then eventually silver. So as a firm, we like to look at long-term trends that are what I call secular in nature. That's when I say secular, they're long-lasting trends. They usually last for a decade. For example, look at commodities in the 1970s, Japan in the 1980s, U.S. stocks and technology in the 90s, commodities in the 00 decade. So what we like to do is invest for a long period of time, and that's why we moved decisively into commodities in the last decade. We begin gradually, and then eventually we began to move and add to those positions over time to take advantage of that cycle. And that cycle played out all the way to roughly the spring and the fall of 2011 when commodities came down. And then with oil, it was in 2014.
Well, then remember, Jim, that in 2007 and 2009, the Fed slashed interest rates to avoid a depression. And that was the worst financial crisis we've gone in since the Great Depression back at the end of the 20s, beginning of the 30s. And that was to keep everything afloat. So that's why they did that. That changed everything. So as you monitored the progress of those events, what were your observations?
Well, I mean, there were a couple of things that happened. In 2009, the Fed launched QE1. And then, of course, as we came to 2010, they launched QE2. And then we had Operation Twist. But what really struck us, especially in 2011, 2012, remember what was going on in 2011? We had the European debt crisis, or the pig crisis. And we knew that the Fed was coming with more quantitative easing, which would eventually drive rates lower. At that time, we saw a peak in commodities, and a lot of this came from intermarket analysis that we were looking at how different markets play off against each other. And as listeners of this show know, back in late 2011, 2012, our emphasis was on dividend-paying stocks because we saw a couple trends in place. Number one, what were pension funds going to do to fund their pensions when the Fed drove interest rates down to zero? Number two, the Fed was basically saying with quantitative easing, hey, we're going to keep doing this stuff and keep rates low until this economy fully recovers. Because even back in 2010, in 2011, we were still dealing with unemployment rate of between 8 and 10%. And so with the yields being driven down through financial repression, what were people going to do for yield? And it was one of those events, John, that was the first time in my financial career that we saw dividend yields higher on stocks than what you could get in the bond market. So we thought that the dividend paying stocks, if you've been a listener to this program, especially blue chip stocks, was the thing to be, because, and I still think that play is going to be around for a while because you've got pension funds that are out there scrambling for yield. I mean, even though the Fed has raised interest rates, do you want 2.5% or would you rather get a dividend yield of 3.5 to 5%? So that shift, I still think, is with us and will be with us for a while here because globally, investors are scrambling for yield. I mean, if you go into the European debt markets, you're getting interest rates below 1%. And even in troubled spots like Italy, Portugal, you're getting debt yields that, as John Murphy pointed out in the first hour, you're getting debt yields in Italy that are lower than U.S. Treasuries. Does that make a lot of sense? It's one of the reasons why one of the bond fund managers or fund that we're using were actually shorting European interest rates, because I think you're going to see those start to climb, which they've already done.
You were talking a lot about these dividend stocks, Jim. We did a lot of shows on them. Do you still believe that they're a valid trend?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I still think that you have a lot of investors. I don't care if it's insurance companies, if it's pension plans, whether it's retired investors. And you remember, the demographics globally are changing. We are moving more towards an aging demographic, not only here in the United States, in Europe, in China, Japan. And what do older investors do? They live off their investments. They're looking for yields, and especially pension funds. I mean, you have one of the largest pension funds in the world, CalPERS. They have an assumption of a 7.5% rate of return for their pension fund. They're not getting anything near that. You're certainly not going to get that in the interest rate market. So they're going to have to move more towards stocks. And I still think one of the things that the Fed is trying to do in normalizing interest rates is protect the next crisis, which we talked about on the show last week, is the pension crisis facing a lot of pension funds, both at the state, local level. How are you going to fund a pension when you have interest rates at probably, you know, the lowest that we've seen in recorded history? So I still think that we're going to be seeing individuals searching for yield. And so that's why I still think that that is going to lead us to what we feel is going to be the next mega trend.
Remember that for the last couple of weeks here on the program, we did some shows on 7 mega trends that we think are going to affect us in the next decade. And then we added 2 more of those and said there are 2 mega trends in addition to those that are going to require a lot more attention, a show of their own. So that's what we did. We did a separate show on infrastructure last week, if you will recall. And this week is the second megatrend, and this is really important, the death of a bull market, because the bond bull market is over, and you have to come to grips with this.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you take a look at you've been an investor probably for the last 36 years, if you're a boomer, you've spent your working career in an investment environment of declining interest rates. If you take a look at the rise in interest rates that began in the mid-50s all the way to August of 1981, I remember this because I got in the business right around that time. And John, I could remember one of my first clients, I put her in a 10-year treasury note at 15%. But in August of 1981, 10-year treasuries peaked at a little over 15.5%. Gosh, would anybody love to get those yields today? If you contrast that, that was August of 1981. July of last year, we hit a secular low of 1.36%. Think back about 9 months ago, we were in negative interest rates. If you were in a 3-month T-bill, you got a negative rate. In other words, you paid the government money to loan them money. Contrast that to where we are today, where 3-month T-bills are at 0.75%. So if you look at where interest rates peaked in 1981, the yield on treasuries dropped by over 90% over a 36-year bull market. And, you know, people made a ton of money by investing in treasuries. In fact, had you bought treasuries over the last 3 decades, you would probably made more or higher returns than you would in the stock market. And this reflects the great bear market in stocks between the year 2000 and April 2013, where the S&P and the Dow virtually went nowhere for 13 years. In fact, my good friend Gary Schilling, who we've had on this program, was one of the big proponents of falling interest rates. I remember reading Gary's first book, I think it was 1982, Deflation Ready or Not, where he was talking about declining interest rates. And of course, that trend lasted for 36 years. And I mean, you could have made a small fortune by investing in treasury bonds and just simply sitting on them and holding them. But I believe, John, that trend is changing and a new secular trend is emerging, and that is going to be a bear market in bonds. And the thing you have to understand when I say a bear market in bonds are a little bit different than bear market in stocks. They tend to be longer duration. They tend to be 25 to 35 years. The average bear market somewhere between 26 and 28 years. And these things play out over a long period of time. The last bear market in bonds began in the late 50s and went all the way up to 1981. And then from 1981 to the summer of last year, you know, we saw a period of declining interest rates, and then also something we've never seen in history before, which was the lowest interest rate on government bonds in recorded human history. In 5,000 years, we'd never seen interest rates decline as much as we did.
The Fed formally began raising interest rates, if you recall, back in 2015 when they raised for the first time. And then we went through the will they, won't they in 2016. And now they just did or announced it this week. But the cycle you're talking about really began much earlier, I would say, when the Fed pretty well announced they weren't going to be, you know, what, printing more money?
Yeah, and people recall back in May of 2013 when Bernanke surprised the markets and he announced that they were going to, that was the formal announcement of taper. Now they held off for 6 months and everybody remembered the hiccup that we saw in the bond market where yields virtually doubled in a 6 month period of time. We went from about 1.6 to 3%. But you have strategists out there, guys like Barry Bannister at Stifel Nicolaus, that believes that the tightening cycle in interest rates actually began in May of 2014. And that's something when you take a look at what we call the shadow funds rate, which is published by the Atlantic Federal Reserve, rates actually bottomed on the shadow funds rate in May of 2014. So if you really look at it, if you take the taper announcement of 2013, the bottom of the shadow funds rate in May of 2014, the first official Fed rate hike of 2015, then we got one in 2016, and then, of course, we just got one this week. So we're at probably, John, a couple years already into this rate-raising cycle. And even though the formal rate hike began in December 2015, it was preceded by these announcements, the announcement of taper, and then also the bottoming of the shadow funds rate, which took place in May of 2014. So what is amazing when you look at this, it has taken us, what, 4 years, almost 4 years, when the Fed first announced taper, or the beginning of taper in, let's say, May of 2013. Here we are almost 4 years later. We're only at a Fed funds rate of 1%, which is where we were in 2004, when in April of that year, Greenspan began announcing that they were going to begin raising interest rates. They raised interest rates April of 2004, a quarter of a point, and they raised interest rates every FOMC meeting all the way until, you know, the economy collapsed and we had the Great Recession. So we're in this cycle, John, already a couple of years, beginning with the announcement of taper. So I believe we probably have another year, maybe year and a half before this cycle ends.
So if we have been in this cycle, like you're talking about, for several years now, I guess the real question is going to be, what's the upside on this? I mean, last time we began at 1% and raised to over 5%. Are they going to, I don't want to use the word taper, are they just going to top out at 5%? Or do we even get to that point before something breaks?
You know, I think they're going to raise rates. You know, I would be surprised if rates don't top out somewhere between 2 and 3%. In other words, if you take a look at the dot plot, which we'll get into in the next segment of the big picture, they're talking about two more rate hikes this year, three next year, which would take us, two more rate hikes this year would get us to 1.5%. Three more rate hikes next year would get us to 2.25%, maybe 2.5%. So, you know, personally, I think I just don't see them getting to 3% before we eventually get into a recession. So I would suspect sometime late 2018, maybe early 2019, this rate raising cycle ends and we go into a recession either late 2018 or beginning of 2019.
Okay, let's combine these two things with what you were just talking about. We know that when the Fed raises rates, that leads to a recession. If they lower the rates, that tends to back off or get us out of a recession. But now we're talking about the end of a bond bull market. And if that's true, how is rate raising going to interact with the end of the bull market?
Well, remember, when you're talking about, let's go to the bond bull market, which began in 1981, we had rates spike. In 1984, we had rates spike. In 1987, we had rates spike. In 1990, 91, they spiked again in 94. They spiked again in 2000. So even though when you take a look at this long secular trend, whether it's up or down in the bond market, it plays out over several decades. So we could go into another recession where the Fed lowers rates, and then we get into an economic recovery. And so picture a bond bull market and a bear market as a series of steps. In a bond bull market, you're at the top of the stairs, gradually walking down those stairs over a period of time. Likewise, in a bond bull market, picture you're at the bottom of the steps, climbing those set of steps over a period of time. So bond markets play out over several economic cycles. The late great Kennedy Gammage, he was a technician, and he used to have a graph. I've used this in articles I've written and also in public seminars, where he talked about this cycle that we go through between paper assets, meaning stocks and bonds, and things are what we call hard assets. And it's taken place. We've had several of these cycles. Think of, you know, the 1970s was a period of time, late 60s and 1970s, where, you know, the best place to be was in commodities. Then you take a look at a paper cycle that lasted between the 80s and 90s. It was best to be in paper assets. The last decade, we were in commodity type assets, and that's what we do. We shift back and forth over longer periods of time between a period of time where paper assets do well to a period of time where I call them things or hard assets do well. So I believe we're returning to that cycle again. I think it began in 2001. The first up leg of that cycle lasted probably from 2001 to 2010, 2011. We've seen a down cycle. And then I think you're going to see a gradual rise in that cycle again. We're seeing this play out. I was just looking at a chart of real estate prices, and they're rising globally. We're seeing real estate prices rise in New Zealand, Australia, Britain, Canada, here in the U.S. And one of the things that's driving it is here in the U.S., despite the increases in real estate prices, we have housing availability shortages. We don't have enough inventory. We have a shortage of construction workers. So this is helping to keep real estate prices elevated, especially at the low end. So I think we're beginning this gradual cycle of rising rates, rising inflation rates, but it's going to play out over a long cycle period of time. This is what we call a secular trend, and these secular trends take time to play out.
This would seem to parallel something that Felix Zuloff said on the Friday FS Insider in an interview with Chris Sheridan. Let me play this for you here.
I think the most important change in the fundamental picture is the rise of inflation. Inflation is coming back, and I'm talking much more about core inflation, not headline inflation. Core inflation is pretty sticky, and I do believe that core inflation will continue to creep upward during the year and next year. And this has not only to do with the U.S. I think this is a global phenomenon. Inflation in many countries is already above declared target levels by the central banks. So I think what we see is the beginning process of monetary policy changes towards less easy money and even towards some tightening.
Again, that was an excerpt from an interview that Chris Sheridan did with Felix Zuloff during FS Insider on Friday from Zuloff Asset Management. He's also a Barron's Roundtable member. But now, given this trend, if we're pursuing this thought, of rising rates and inflations, how are you positioning yourself for this trend to anticipate it?
Well, I mean, as anybody that's been listening to this show over the last couple of years, we've been talking about using individual bonds with short-term maturities, and we'll get into the next segment in terms of our bond strategy that we're using given this change. Because as rates rise, if I have, let's say I have a one-year bond that matures in 1 year, or I have a bond that matures in 2 or 3 years, as the Fed begins to raise interest rates, when that bond matures, I get my money back and I can invest it at a higher rate. So, and the other thing that we're doing is looking for specialty funds that have what is called short duration, meaning that their portfolio is short. And we're looking for bond fund managers that are active that are shorting bonds. Like one of the things that we like right now is shorting the European debt markets, because interest rates in Europe got to the negative interest rates. I mean, whether you were looking at Swiss government bonds, German government bonds, if you were looking at British gilts, if you were looking at German bunds, all these bonds had negative interest rates. And so it just, to me, just spoke with, as this shift begins to take place, that that was a place to be. So basically, we're looking at short-term bonds or shorting certain sectors of the bond market globally, because the cycle that we're talking about, rising interest rates, is going to take place over several decades and several economic cycles. And so one of the things that we're looking at is there are three main larger items that here or themes that are going to play out. One is the economy, two is financial markets, and three are what we call trend breakouts in sectors. Because when you move from one paradigm and you shift into another, that also means that there's going to be rotation in the market. So on the economy, we're following the business cycle and the stages of the cycle. In the financial markets, we're looking at this standard mean reversion process that you get, whether when you get to a bottom in interest rates or you get to high PE levels in the market as we are today. And then also, given those two changes, either a shift in the economy or the shift in the market, you look for trend changes, because whenever you go through a major paradigm shift, imagine, think back to, let's say, 2013, when Bernanke first announced, hey, we're going to end taper and not print money anymore. And the disruption of volatility that we saw in the bond market that lasted about 6 months. And then when the Fed began to raise interest rates, look how volatile and how the markets virtually went nowhere in 2015. So whenever you get these regime changes, they tend to be disruptive. And what you see is this disruption is really nothing more than a transitioning phase from one regime change that we've seen, which has been defined by central bank accommodation and financial repression, and low growth, low inflation, and low yields. Now, I think we're shifting. We're shifting to away from central bank accommodation. We're first here in the U.S., just as we were first in lowering rates, and also we were first in QE. So I think this is going to play out in terms of what the Fed is doing here is going to play out in Europe. It's going to play out elsewhere. So we're moving from financial repression and accommodation. Now what we're seeing is rates are beginning to rise globally. Governments, as we covered last week in infrastructure, are spending money, vast sums of money, $26 trillion over the next 10 years on infrastructure, which was the mega trend we talked about last week. And so we're shifting from falling interest rates to rising interest rates, from shrinking budget deficits to rising budget deficits, from low money velocity to higher money velocity and higher rates of inflation. So in this transition period, you're going to look at, what are you going to see? You're seeing rising interest rates. You're going to see rising inflation. We're seeing those two things take place. And what we're looking for to confirm that trend is rising velocity, which is a function of credit. So also we're going to see changes on the investment front.
I guess what's coming through my mind here is when you say changes on the investment front, there's an implication here. What is it?
Well, I mean, it changes on the investment front. One of the reasons you've had low money velocity is, you know, credit has not been turning over. The credit cycle has been muted. So as the Fed begins to raise interest rates and the yield curve steepens, it creates an incentive for banks to make loans. You know, even though the Fed raised interest rates this week, if you're a depositor sitting on cash, the bad news, they're unlikely to raise rates for you as a cash investor or, let's say, a CD investor, because banks are going to take advantage of the spread between what they pay you, the depositor, and what they can charge on making a loan. I don't care if it's mortgage rates. Mortgage rates are up about a full percentage point. Car loans will be going up. And so the distance between what they have to pay you for money and what they can charge you to borrow expands their profit margin. As banks do that, what does that mean? It's going to actually create incentives for moving credit through the system, which also helps economic growth. Another thing that you're going to see, if you take a look at companies in this era of financial repression, what companies did is they basically used financial engineering, whether it was buying back stock, refinancing their bonds, expanding their margins, or using leverage. That was the trend for the last 8 years. Going forward, that trend is playing out. As interest rates rise, it becomes more expensive for companies to expand on that trend. So the only way that they're going to be able to increase their bottom line is start increasing their top line. And we're seeing that with several companies restructuring. We're seeing that with a major soft drink company that is restructuring its whole operations, removing its capital intensive part of its operation so they can increase their return on equity and also their top line. So this is going to play out in various ways. You're going to see it in CapEx investment. You're going to see it in credit cycles. You're going to see it take place in economic growth rates. When you're talking about government spending vast sums of money, the Trump administration is talking about $1 trillion here, although I think that's a 2019-2020 story, as we talked about last week. But anyway, we're talking about a rotation that's going to be coming to the markets.
If we look at the bear market of 2000, 2002, maybe 2007, 2009, we've talked before about the sequence that all bull markets go through. There seems to be a very definite series of stages. If we take those stages and apply them to what's happening now, how is that sequence playing out?
You know, it's very similar to something John Murphy and I talked about in hour one. Usually, if we take a look at, let's just look at the last 4 or 5 decades, you usually see a spike in oil prices, think 1974, 1981, 1991, 2001, 2007. Every one of those recessions and bear markets began with a spike in oil prices, which leads to higher inflation rates, which leads to the Fed raising interest rates. And so what typically happens is if you take a look at asset classes, the main ones that people invest in, bonds, stocks, and commodities. The first asset class to peak is bonds, and I think we've already seen that. The next asset class to peak is usually stocks, because as interest rates are rising, that what the Fed is basically saying here is, look, we think economic growth is healthy enough, we could start raising rates. So that gives a bit of confidence to investors. And so we still think, as John mentioned in the first hour, is that the stock market still has a ways to go, but I think there's going to be a major rotation in terms of the stocks that lead the cycle. So bonds have peaked. Stocks are the next asset class to peak, and I think we're a ways away from that. And then finally, which would coincide with the peaking of an economic cycle, would be commodities would be the last peak. And that's the way it played out between 1999 and 2000. It played out the same way between 2007 and 2008. So following that same cycle, we've seen it already in the bond market. I think stocks and commodities are what we're looking for to play out next.
Now, given that we all have theories about what's going on, how are you getting some positive feedback on it? What are the indicators you're monitoring to confirm that this is what's going on and what you should be doing?
You know, we're watching a lot of key intermarket relationships, as John and I talked about in hour one, and especially we're focusing on commodities. I agree with John. I think energy and some of these commodities are close to a bottom cycle. And then what we're also doing is looking for a confirmation in sector rotations. As I discussed with John, one of the things that, you know, we've been monitoring and picking up here over the last couple months was the divergence that we were seeing between a commodity price such as gold versus the gold stocks or oil versus the energy stocks. And so these are the things that we're watching to unfold. So commodities and intermarket relationships are going to confirm whether our thesis is playing out and we're correct on that trend.
And as we always do here on the program, if we've discussed all of this, what are the investment implications?
Well, I think we are in the final stages of this business cycle and bull market. So you're going to see sector rotation into things like industrials, tech, materials, and energy. And, you know, we still like dividend paying stocks. The difference, you know, once again, depends on an individual client. I mean, for example, if you're more of a conservative investor, if I was investing in energy, I would be looking more for the higher dividend paying international companies. If you're a growth investor, I'd be looking at oil companies that have the ability to increase their production every year, because that's increasing production means you're selling more barrels of oil. If the price of oil goes up, plus you're selling more barrels of oil, that's going to be a growth story. There's a little bit more risk there, but that's more appropriate for somebody that's a growth-oriented client versus somebody that's an income client. But my sense is, every time you go through a regime change, what you see is market volatility. I mean, think back 2013, think back to 2015, and think back 2016. And the major regime change in 2016 was the election of Donald Trump and Brexit. So we do have some risks here that are possible. I mean, if rates were to rise much faster than expected, that could be a risk for these markets. But so far, given what the Fed said this week, it was a very dovish Fed. And that's why you've seen the markets react. You've seen bond yields fall. Stock prices ended up on a positive note. Emerging markets are breaking out. And so all of that is telling us that this trend has much further to go and to play out. What I look for is, what's going to be interesting is to see, which we'll cover in our next topic, what unfolds as the markets brace for what the Fed is going to do next, which is a likely another rate hike coming as soon as June.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Different indicators tell different stories, and I think it's very, very important to understand what each specific indicator and number actually implies. For example, you know, the U3 rate is very different from the U6 unemployment rate. For instance, the U3 unemployment rate does not include those who are underemployed, for example, those who may be working part-time for economic reasons but would rather be working full-time. So to give you a sense of the difference in numbers there, in January of 2017, the U6 rate was 9.4%, considerably higher from the U3 rate, or the official rate of 4.8%. I think the other thing, too, that the U3 unemployment rate doesn't account for is the labor force participation rate, which has fallen considerably in recent years. You know, it's fallen from about 67% to 63%. And when you multiply that 4% drop off of over 300 million people, closer to 330 million people, is what the U.S. population is, according to the latest census estimate. That's a lot of people. And so I do think that there's a case to be made that, you know, maybe we are not looking at the right labor market indicators, or we really need to be looking at a labor market dashboard. And that's, I think, something that Janet Yellen has espoused, and I think a number of other economists have espoused. I don't think it is particularly new that there's criticism of just focusing on the U3 rate. Bernie Sanders, for example, also was very critical of only tracking the U3 rate in particular. So I think to get the full story on what's happening in the labor market, I think you need to look at a collection of indicators, not just one particular unemployment rate.
Do you get a headache like I do trying to understand all those chairmen from the Federal Reserve? First there was Greenspeak, and then Bernanke babble, and now, not to fear, from Pupsoft, makers of the Bernanke Babble Dictionary, comes the latest upgrade, the Janet Yellen Yap App. That's right. The Janet Yellen Yap app will instantly translate the pronouncements of our new fickle femme fatale of befuddling Fed phrasing.
With the harsh winter behind us, many recent indicators suggest that a rebound in spending and production is already underway.
It stopped snowing. Let's go shopping.
The Yellen Yap app is a must for everyone who wants to understand the wacky world of Fedflations, where more means less, and less usually means more than less, unless, of course, it's less than more. More or less. Remember how you used to fall asleep when Ben Bernanke spoke? Well, it's amazing. That won't happen anymore. The Janet Yellen Yap app also comes complete with a Snooze Fuse pocket self-tasing plug-in. Yeah, you won't dare nod off again during hours of boring Yellen testimony before Congress.
Boy, that hurt.
Eventually, as we come closer to normalization, I expect we will give such guidance.
Later, dude.
So download your Janet Yellen Yap app today with the Snooze Fuse self-tasing add-on and do it before quantitative easing or the batteries run out.
Today, the Federal Open Market Committee decided to raise the target range for the federal funds rate by 0.25 percentage point, bringing it to 0.75% to 1%. Our decision to make another gradual reduction in the amount of policy accommodation reflects the economy's continued progress toward the employment and price stability objectives assigned to us by law. For some time, the committee has judged that if economic conditions evolved as anticipated, gradual increases in the federal funds rate would likely be appropriate to achieve and maintain our objectives. Today's decision is in line with that view and does not represent a reassessment of the economic outlook or of the appropriate course for monetary policy.
Okay, the very familiar voice of Fed Chair Janet Yellen. She announced that after the FOMC meeting occurred that they were going to be raising interest rates by 0.25 point. This is the third time they've done that. This puts the federal funds rate at 1% and where we were at the beginning of the last rate raising cycle back in 2004. So aside from putting us there, Jim, what does that mean?
Well, it was rather interesting because there was a lot of speculation given where the financial markets are. And I think one of the reasons the Fed was able to go in March has a lot to do with what's going on in the stock market. Let's put it this way. If the stock market was reacting in any way like it was last year, where we saw falling commodity prices with stock prices down every single week, there's no way that they would have been raising rates as they did this week. But there was speculation coming up till this week's meeting that would they change the dot plots? And if you're not familiar with the dot plots, that's where various Fed governors say, this is where we think future interest rates are going. So there was speculation that with things going well and the Fed feeling more confident that they might even get more aggressive. So in other words, they might raise the dot plot. Well, that didn't happen. So they left the dot plot alone. Basically, they raised rates 0.25 point, which is why you saw the reaction in various asset classes this week with the breakout of emerging markets, a fall in bonds, a fall in the dollar, and of course, the rise in stocks. So you're asking the question, where are they going forward? Well, they basically left the dot plot unchanged, implying that this is the first of three rate hikes. Remember, in December last year, the Fed kind of threw a curve to the markets when they were looking at 2017 instead of two rate hikes. They said, no, we're going to raise that to three. We're feeling more confident in terms of where the economy is going. What has been rather interesting over the last 12 months, when you take a look at when the Fed first announced they were going to start raising interest rates, going back to 2014, they actually raised rates one time in 2015, there was a big spread between what the futures market was saying the Fed was going to do and what the Fed was saying it's going to do. And everybody remembers 2015, they were going to raise interest rates three or four times. They raised it once. Fast forward to 2016, they were going to raise it four times. They raised it only once. And so the futures market spread was way, way different. And of course, the futures market was the one that was right. What we've seen happen over the last 12 months is there's been a narrowing between the futures market and the Fed's own dot plot. So they're more in alignment with each other, indicating what they're going to do going forward.
Well, now that we know that they're going to be raising rates, that seems to be the commitment there. Will the next raise occur, what, at the next meeting, the next time they can do this?
Well, if you take a look at the next FOMC meeting, they skip April, they meet in May, and they also meet in June. If you look at the futures market, there is less a likelihood that they go in May. And I think given that the fact that the economy is sort of weakened in the fourth quarter and it's kind of weak right now in the first quarter, we're still growing. I think they're going to watch to see how financial markets react and watch what the economic numbers. So if you look at the futures market is saying right now, there's about a 51% chance that they go in June. And so the consensus, at least according to the futures market and what the market believes, remember, you go back 6 weeks ago and nobody was believing they were going to raise rates in March, which they just did. The widespread belief going back 6 weeks ago was the first rate hike would come in June. Well, that's the consensus right now. That's where the futures market says the next rate hike comes in June. And then after that, there will not be another rate hike, at least looking at what the futures market is saying. You know, given two rate hikes and also the fact they're probably, you're going to start hearing, and I expect to hear this in the May meeting, where they start talking about shrinking their balance sheet, which is another form of tightening. So given that, the futures market is saying they go again in June, quarter of a point, and then they go again in December. Right now, the futures market has about a 36% probability in December. I look for those percentages to increase just as they did for the March meeting. So what happened is, as a result, the markets viewed this as a much more dovish Fed than what the Fed governors were saying prior to the March meeting. I mean, you had Dudley and Yellen making a speech saying, hey, we're going to raise rates. So everybody was saying, Fed is turning more hawkish. Well, this meeting turned out to be less hawkish. They left the dot plots. They emphasized the fact that rate hikes going forward are expected to be gradual in nature. And that's the word the market wants to hear, gradual.
But here we had the announcement by the Fed, and the market's reaction to it all didn't seem to be what you would probably expect. Stocks were up, bond yields fell, so did the dollar. How do you explain all that?
I think the real key here, John, was everybody was expecting a more hawkish Fed. In other words, they would have changed the dot plots very much like what they did in December when they gave their forecast for the following year. They changed it and they said, no, we're not going to raise interest rates two times. We are so confident we're going to raise interest rates three times. So the markets were anticipating something of that kind of nature because remember, prior to a couple months ago, nobody thought the Fed was going to be raising interest rates given the slowdown in economic growth in the fourth quarter and then in the first quarter of this year, which is, we've got, what, another couple weeks here for this to play out. So nobody was expecting any change until June, and here we are in March, and they just raised interest rates. So they were looking for some kind of change mechanism like raising the dot plots. Hey, we're getting more aggressive here. That didn't happen. The dot plot remained the same. So basically, you had this kind of sigh of relief. Okay, we can live with one rate hike and a couple rate hikes this year because that's already been priced in the market. So the thing that they were really looking for was sort of a more hawkish statement in what this was in the press conference and everything leading up afterwards is it was less hawkish than anticipated, which the markets liked.
So economic growth slowed in the fourth quarter and was expected to be weak in the first quarter. I guess the real question, although we're saying that the economy, at least the Fed saying the economy's puttering right along, are in reality they making a mistake by raising rates so soon in March? And could we be actually approaching some kind of a stalling speed here?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at what happened in the first quarter, I think it has a lot to do with an increase in imports, which subtracts from GDP growth. So we had a sharp fall in exports and we had a plunge in inventories, which was one of the main things that drove economic growth in the third quarter. However, if we take a look at other indicators, the labor markets remain strong. The NFIB, which is the National Federation of Independent Businesses, this is small business optimism, is at record levels. Home builder survey is high. Consumer sentiment remains at a level that we haven't seen. You'd have to go back to 2004 to 2006. You're certainly seeing this in sectors that are performing well within the S&P. For example, discretionary type stocks are doing well. So, John, there's no near-term danger of a recession at the moment. Once again, I think of the recession, it's going to take a lot more rate hikes. Remember, we're starting, even though the Fed raised interest rates, we're only at 1%. That's where we started in 2004. So, you know, they got a long ways here before they get to some trouble. So there is no danger of recession at this point. The key with the Fed, in my personal opinion, is what has allowed them to go forward and raise as early as March is this double-digit return that we've seen in the stock market with the election of Donald Trump, because the stock markets are up double digits from November 8th. You've seen commodity prices rise. You've seen stock prices rise. And so that has given the Fed confidence to go forward raising rates. And as long as the markets are doing well, that gives the Fed the confidence to proceed going forward. And it's one of the reasons why, because all of these rate hikes have been priced into the market this year. In other words, the market could live with 3 rate hikes this year. And that's why the markets reacted the way they did this week, is because the Fed didn't change anything like they did in December. We had that brief interruption there. So that is something that is kind of key here. And once again, as long as the financial markets cooperate, I think that we're probably heading towards another rate hike coming up in June, number one, assuming the financial markets continue their upward trend.
Well, given the fact that the financial markets are cooperating right now, then the next issue, of course, that the Fed's always worried about is inflation. And there were comments made that their expectations for inflation were beginning to rise right toward the Fed's goal of 2%.
Well, you know, remember, we have had a firming of inflation expectations. And I think another factor contributing to the market this week is we've had a drop in inflationary expectations. A lot of that had to do with this reversal in the futures market by speculative traders on the price of oil. We've had oil pull back from the mid-50s to below $50. And here we are on this Friday in the $48 to $49 range. So, but there is a growing realization too, I believe, in Washington. Remember, the markets have moved up, inflation expectations, bond yields have all moved up with the election of Donald Trump, because Donald Trump was going to, he had 3 things in his economic platform. Number one, he was going to lower tax rates to stimulate the economy. Number two, he was going to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. Number three, he was going to cut regulations. Well, I think there's a growing realization in Washington that Trump's big agenda is going to take time to enact. So stimulus coming from either tax cuts or spending on fiscal infrastructure, that's going to take time to implement. They're talking about if we get tax cuts, it's probably going to be towards the end of the year. If we get infrastructure, that's probably going to be towards the end of the year. Right now, they're moving on healthcare first. That's the first thing they're going to move on. Next, they're going to move on tax reform. And finally, infrastructure. And of course, the president is also moving on deregulation through his cabinet post and executive orders. So I think right now, there is this kind of relief. Okay, the markets are saying this stuff is going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight. So that's removing some of the pressure on the bond market and inflationary expectations, and also on oil. But for right now, the economy is muddling along, which gives the Fed more room to raise rates gradually.
We have carried out a modest adjustment of the federal funds rate because we've seen the economy progressing over the last several months in exactly the way that we anticipated. We haven't in any way changed our view about where the economy is heading or the risks. We had long said that if the economy progressed, and it's, you know, it's been doing nicely, I think, in making progress and showing resilience, and have some confidence in the path the economy's on. And if we continue to feel that, we will likely regard it as appropriate to make some further moves to scale back accommodation, to move toward neutral along the lines in the SEP.
Once again, Janet Yellen this week from the Fed's Open Market Committee press announcement. So What are you going to do in terms of future clues as to what the Fed may be doing to try to anticipate that, and then also what the market's reaction is probably going to be if there's another hike?
Right now, you've got PMIs rising not only here, but also globally. So the thing that we're watching very closely are the commodity markets and the dollar in terms of a clue going forward. Because remember, dollar and commodities move in opposite direction. Dollar declines, commodities rise, dollar rises, commodities fall. So we're looking at very economic sensitive commodities. We're watching the oil market. We're watching the copper market, base metals, and silver for the clues that as an economic cycle progresses, and especially towards the end, you normally see that sequence we talked about. Bonds peak first, stock second, and then commodities. So we're watching the commodity markets very closely. And I'm sort of leaning in the direction that Murphy is, that energy prices are close to a bottom here. And so we're also watching for inflation expectations to change going forward as the year progresses.
A couple of years ago, we included the word symmetric in our statement of longer run goals. And this seemed like an appropriate time to introduce that word into the statement because we had previously indicated that there was a shortfall of inflation from our 2% objective. Now, headline inflation has moved almost back up to 2%. As I indicated, a better forward-looking measure of inflation, core inflation, that's not our target, but I think it's worth looking at because it's a better forward-looking predictor of headline inflation. I think that's still running a little bit under 2%, but we expect it's going to move up to 2. And this seemed like a good time to remind Americans that what our objective is 2% inflation. Inflation is not always going to be at 2%. Like all economic variables, it fluctuates. Sometimes it's going to be below 2%. Sometimes it's going to be above 2%. We've had a long period in which inflation has run under 2%. As we move back to 2%, which is where we're heading, there will be some times when it's above 2% as well. And it's a reminder, 2% is not a ceiling on inflation. It's a target. It's where we always want inflation to be heading. And there will be some times when inflation is above 2%, just like it's been below 2%. We're not shooting for inflation above 2%, but it's a reminder that there will be deviations above and below when we're achieving our objective.
Once again, Janet Yellen confirming the goal of 2% inflation. As you look for clues, Jim, especially in commodity prices, I mean, we've seen oil double. What about some of the other things like base metals, copper, things along those lines?
Well, if you take a look at copper, they always call it Dr. Copper because it tells you more about what's going on economically, not only here, but around the globe. Copper bottomed in December of 2015, January of 2016, and it's been an upward trend. We broke above a long-standing resistance level. We pulled back, but we're heading back up. So we're watching copper. We're looking at oil. For oil to break out, it's pulled back here, but a lot of that was a reversal of speculative trades in the futures market. And that was the big thing that we saw that impacted markets and also inflation expectations as the price of oil has pulled back from around 55 to around 48. So, but anyway, commodities still remain in an uptrend, including energy. So we're watching that. And the other thing that was a key is we're seeing emerging markets break out, and we're also seeing emerging market currencies, especially resource currencies. You know, we're watching Brazil, we're watching Australia, we're watching Canada, the countries that produce a lot of commodities that are used in economic infrastructure and also in economic growth.
So the Fed has raised interest rates. This is now for the third time. So what are you doing to manage things amidst this regime change?
Well, I mean, we're doing a number of things. As I mentioned in the last segment, we're keeping to short-term bonds, individual bonds with 2 to 3 year maturities. We're invested in a particular bond fund known for shorting. They are taking short positions on European sovereign debt, which is working out well because rates are starting to rise globally and especially in Europe. And the other thing we're doing is we're doing what is called a barbell approach, where we're buying adjustable rate notes that are tied to LIBOR, meaning that as rates rise, these notes will raise their interest rates as well. And then we're also buying high quality corporate bonds where we're getting 5 to 6% yields on the long end, let's say 10-year end. And then also we're shorting basically euro government debt, because remember, folks, last year, I mean, I don't care where you looked. I mean, if you were looking at Portugal, if you were looking at Switzerland, if you were looking at Germany, where we had negative interest rates, well, we've now coming off those negative interest rates, which means the value of bonds are going down. And we're also moving into international markets. So, you know, in the stock market area, we're looking at materials, healthcare, energy, biotechnology, basically sectors that have been beaten up is where we're looking at and going shopping. Because, I mean, if you take a look at one of the most bullish technicians we've had on the program here has been Craig Johnson. And his target this year is 2424. He's probably right at the top of the list of Wall Street strategists in terms of where the market is going. So that it really isn't much different from where we are right now with the S&P at 2378, you're talking at 2424. John, you're only talking about another 2 or 3% increase in the S&P this year. So if we can get 3 to 5% in yields, either in dividends or interest rates, you know, we think that is a much less riskier area to play in this kind of market as we go through this transition. There's less risk and less volatility. I mean, even though the Fed's raised interest rates, good luck trying to get a decent return on your CDs or money market funds. You know, I'd rather be getting 4 and 5% either in dividends or in interest. But unfortunately, in this kind of market, you're going to have to shop globally to look at get those trends. And then you're also going to have to look at sectors of the market today where you have, you know, it's probably the second most expensive market that we've seen in U.S. history. So, you know, we're looking at areas that are beaten up that offer the best opportunity, because I think just chasing the market with an index, if there's only another 2 or 3% upside in the market, I'd rather get 3, 4 or 5% in interest or dividends as part of my return. Anything on top of that is a bonus.
So I have a question here, Jim. How's your contrarian spirit holding out? Because I know typically in times past when people are fearful, you're probably buying. If they're calm, that's when you're very, very cautious. You're always going the opposite direction.
We're still playing a very defensive position here. I mean, when it comes to stocks, we're shopping globally. We're looking for beaten up sectors of the market. I mean, if I can pick up a 3, 4 and as much as a 5% dividend yield, you know, I'll take that any day versus trying to bet on just pure growth in the stock market. And likewise, in the bond market, we're using floating rate bonds, meaning as rates begin to rise gradually, as we know they're going to do, then the interest rates on those bonds will rise along with rising interest rates. Same thing with short-term bonds. And then also, I think when you see negative interest rates, as we saw last year in Europe, you know, I would be shorting the European sovereign debt market, because that is something that I think that Europe is behind the U.S. We were the first to start quantitative easing. Europe is still in a quantitative easing mode. Gradually, they're going to get to a taper mode, as the Fed did when it began taper in 2014. I think that's ahead of Europe, and what that is going to mean is rising interest rates there. So, John, we're still playing defensive, and we're trying to go for things that are less volatile, less risky, because I think 2017 is a year fraught with some risk, mainly political risk. So much of what's going to happen to this market is going to determine on what happens to elections in France, what happens to things that happen in Washington. And of course, there's always geopolitical risk. So there are a lot of things out there that you just can't control or predict, which is one reason why we're remaining cautious.
Well, that's the subject of the week, I guess. That is, the Fed came and they raised interest rates. They came, they raised, and, well, they're going to do that. And I guess what's next? You know, are we going to anticipate another rate raise, or are there other important things out there we should be observing?
Next thing up for that we're going to be watching, we're going to be watching those LAIs, the economic numbers. We are going to end Q1 here in another 2 weeks. And what does that mean? We'll get a fresh batch of economic numbers for the first quarter of this year. We're also entering into Q1 earnings season. So we're going to be watching what companies are saying. If you're going to miss your quarterly estimates in terms of your projections, well, you're going to get that dirty laundry out here in the next couple of weeks. And so in the month of April, we're going to be looking at economic numbers and Q1 earnings to see what happens there. And especially that would probably be one of the next catalysts for the stock market, is earnings come out better than expected. So we're looking at that, all that in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here in the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.